Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. Broadcasting from WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. At this year's James Beard Awards, Alon Shaya won the coveted title Best Chef of the South. But the food that Alon has become famous for isn't Southern at all. His Italian restaurants, Dominica and Pizza Dominica, have been hugely successful. And this spring, he opened the Israeli-inspired Shaya. What exactly is Israeli food? Alon explores that topic on this week's show. One of the flavors that inspire Shaya's menu is Greek cuisine. We'll visit with the volunteer cooks of Holy Trinity Cathedral, the oldest Greek Orthodox church in America, and hear how food and religion are deeply entwined within their faith. Then Greek cooking authority Rosemary Barron takes us on a trip to Crete to learn how this ancient cuisine has survived the ages. We're traveling to the sunny Greek Isles without ever leaving the bayou on this week's Louisiana Eats.
My name is Alon Shaya, and I'm a chef owner of Dominica Restaurant, Pizza Dominica, and Shaya Restaurant. It's been a dream come true. It's an amazing opportunity to cook the foods that I grew up cooking with my mother and my grandmother, and the foods that I cook at home a lot for my wife and for my family during holidays. I'm finally able to cook it for hundreds of people a day.
As the 2015 winner of the James Beard Award for Best Chef of the South, Alon Shaya has come a long way since he first learned to cook as a child, growing up in an Israeli family. First, establishing himself in New Orleans as a collaborating partner to Chef John Besh, his culinary talent and strong-rooted sense of Israeli cuisine led him to open a new restaurant that transforms the many flavors of the Hebrew diaspora that now converge in present-day Israel. Alon sat down to talk with us shortly after Shaya opened to share his inspiration for the restaurant's amazing menu and explain what the Israeli food tradition means to him.
I was born in Israel. My mother is Israeli, and my father is Romanian, and my grandparents are Bulgarian. So when I was four, my family immigrated to Philadelphia, and that's where I grew up. Finally landed in New Orleans in 2003, and just fell head over heels for it, and really called it my home right away. And I've never had any thoughts of leaving since I got dropped off in New Orleans.
And you get dropped off in like a perfect place, because somehow you ended up in the same spot with our dear buddy Chef John Besh, and
yeah.
The rest from there is history, huh?
Yeah. So John and I met in 2003, and I was the chef de cuisine for Besh Steak for a couple of years, and then Katrina hit, and then we got through all that and got the steakhouse reopened, and then, just like most people during Katrina, did a lot of soul searching and really kind of asking myself, where do I really want to do in life? I had always cooked Italian food. It was always a huge passion of mine. And the reason I started cooking Italian food, I feel, in Philadelphia when I was in high school, was because I was reminded a lot of those flavors that I loved so much of the food that I grew up eating, the roasted eggplants and peppers and goat cheese and olive oil and garlic and all the things that, you know, the Israeli food is so wonderful for. I saw a lot of that in Italian food, and I was just drawn to it. So after Katrina, I moved to Italy and spent a year living in Italy, working with families, you know, living above the restaurant, working downstairs, and came back in 2009 and opened Dominica in partnership with John.
And what was really great about Dominica is that even though it was an Italian restaurant and still is an Italian, then next thing you know, you have Pizza Dominica, the second one, on special occasions, you just really showed your Israeli roots off and cooked Seder supper and cooked Hanukkah supper.
Yeah.
And you always had this very strong Jewish outreach with the food, even though you were in an Italian restaurant.
Sure. Yeah, because, you know, it was special to me. Just like I love cooking Thanksgiving meals. It's one of my favorite things of the year to cook. I love cooking for Hanukkah and for Passover and for Rosh Hashanah. So we started doing these meals at Dominica and got such a great response. Hundreds of people would show up to come and taste this food. So naturally, I was like, okay, people like this stuff. Let's see if I can take it, you know, and really continue to push the limits with this. And I found right before Shia opened that Dominica's menu started looking more and more like an Israeli restaurant. Like, you know, so Israeli food. Let's talk about Israeli food because it's something that is so new. It's such a burgeoning cuisine that really so many people don't know anything about it.
Even in Israel.
I've been to Israel and sat on panels with chefs from Israel. And we could have sat there for 4 or 5 hours and talked about what is Israeli cuisine. So here's what it is to me. Israel, when it became a country in 1948, it went from 600,000 residents in the early part of the century to over 6 million residents today. Those people didn't all sprout out of the ground. They all came from somewhere. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, after World War II, there was a huge influx of Eastern Europeans, of, you know, French Jews, German Jews, Polish, also people from Yemen, people from Morocco, from Greece, from Turkey. All, you know, a lot of the Jewish people in those countries, when Israel became a country, went there because that was the new, you know, Jewish state.
It was the new homeland.
It was the new homeland. So over the years, it's been this beautiful combination of cultures. And of course, that's also caused a lot of controversies there throughout the years as well. But something that's been very positive that has come out of like the combination of all these cultures coming there is the food, because everybody needs to eat, so everybody cooks. And all of these cultures starting to kind of intermingle, and the food that the Greeks had been cooking in Greece for hundreds or thousands of years, all of a sudden started to change a little bit. And you can say that about every other country. Just like Italian food, when the Italians came to America, you know, the food changed.
Give us a thumbnail sketch of the Israeli food movement that I believe you're like on the cusp of. You're going to be one of the leaders in the United States on this, but give us a sketch of what else is happening in the rest of the United States when it comes to the style of food that you're cooking at Shia.
Well, I mean, and the reason that I don't necessarily, I'm not inventing anything, or I don't believe like I'm creating anything that's new per se. I know that there are some, you know, there's chefs in the country that are cooking amazing Middle Eastern food or cooking amazing you know, Greek or Moroccan food. And I love the fact that we can kind of pick and pool a lot of those things together and put them together into one story on a menu. I kind of feel like I have an idea of how people like to eat and what food gets people excited. And it always has to start with that for me. And one of the perfect examples is our kibbeh. And kibbeh is usually a combination of ground beef and lamb, and we serve the raw version, the kibbeh. We put ground walnuts, bulgur wheat, mint, pomegranate molasses, preserved lemon. All that gets mixed into this tartare, and then we serve that with this Yemenite flatbread called malawach. And that is like, imagine taking like croissant dough and just like roasting it in clarified butter on in a saute pan.
Oh,
you know, like
gracious.
it puffs up and it gets really golden brown and crispy and buttery and flaky.
You're making me weak in my knees.
So the kibineya is very Lebanese. The malawach is very Yemenite. But those two cultures are cooking for each other now in Israel. That's the way that I kind of think about the food, and it allows me to be really creative without overstretching the creativity and then the food kind of not making any sense.
No, it's a beautiful way that you have handled this, because the food does, nothing seems contrived. Nothing seems, it all is just like a natural evolution. And the first time I came to see you here at Shaya, you just could hardly wait to show off your new toy.
Well, we have a beautiful wood-burning oven that is in the corner of our dining room that produces the fluffiest, hottest, most crispy pita bread that I've ever had. And, you know, the pita, everybody asks me, what's my favorite thing on the menu? And I say the pita bread. Because we've all had bad pita bread before.
Yes, we have.
You know what I'm talking about, right? It's that, like, two layers of recycled UPS cardboard that's put in a Ziploc bag. You know, we make our dough, of course, from scratch, and we allow it to age and slow proof, and it puffs up, and it has this big steamy pocket on the inside. So when you rip it apart at the table, you know, it's like hot, it's crispy on the outside, it's soft on the inside. And then the menu is really built to eat with pita. Like,
right.
That's the way to go. So the whole middle section of the menu is all 10 different little salads and spreads that are constantly going to be changing throughout the seasons. And if you order those, and the pita bread will automatically come, and then you just start to dip and spread and spoon some of this on the bread and dip some of that into the pita and then pass it around the table and try different combinations. That really is what I feel like creates the identity for the restaurant.
So we talked earlier about holidays at Domenica, and of course, you all have just had Passover here at Shaya for the very first time. Describe to me the experience that you saw families having and what that meant to you.
Well, you know, it's always been a very special dinner that we've put on. And this year, of course, with the opening of Shaya, it's just even meant that much more. A lot of people come that are just interested in what the Passover Seder is. You know, it's not about being Jewish or not being Jewish. It's just about enjoying food and enjoying maybe exploring or learning something new about a cuisine or about a traditional holiday meal that you may not have known before. I just watched families and children all really enjoying their time together, going through a lot of the ceremonial steps of the Passover Seder.
Tell us about that, because, you know, the Passover really does involve a very religious ceremony. And so how was that accomplished in a restaurant dining room?
Well, every family is able to experience it the way that they want to. So we have these books that kind of tell the story of Passover, Haggadah. And typically you will take the Haggadah and you'll sit with your family and you'll start reading through the stories. When it comes time to take that first sip of wine, you say the prayer over the wine. Some families sat for an hour prior to eating anything and went through the whole story, and the children read parts of the story, and, you know, they went through the entire prayer book. Other families came in and said, let's drink. Where's the wine? Get some food out on the table. We allow every family to kind of enjoy it the way that they want to. And you see, like, kids singing and saying the prayers, and brings back a lot of my memories as being a child and doing that with my family, and being able to kind of open the doors to a place that I get to spend all my time in and have families come and do that is one of the most magical and remarkable things that I feel like I've ever done in my career. And it's really brings me to the reason that I ever became a chef, and that is solely to bring happiness to people, you know. And that's, you know, you don't do this to become rich. You don't do this to become famous. You do this because you enjoy bringing people happiness through food and hospitality. When I can look over a room and see families really spending that time together and enjoying something that means more than just dinner, it's just breathtaking for me.
Alon Shaya, chef and co-owner of Shaya Restaurant. When we come back from a short break, we'll visit with the volunteers at Holy Trinity Greek Orthodox Church to learn just what it takes to feed the huge crowds that flock to their annual Greek Fest. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Αγόρι μου, στολίδι μου, σαν γέρνεις και μ' αγγίζεις. When you cruise out to Lake Pontchartrain along Bayou St. John, you'll eventually see a cathedral with a green domed roof. That's the Holy Trinity Greek Orthodox Church, the oldest Greek Orthodox church in America. In 1974, the church started an annual celebration they call New Orleans Greek Fest, which satiates attendees with authentic Greek culture and cuisine. Every year, members of the community gather at the church to prepare the festival's desserts, which are made by hand, one batch at a time. Here's Bella Bouton, sitting down at a table laying out Phoenicia dough with her sisters.
Now, we have been coming here now for over 40 years doing the same things. These are things our mother taught us how to do. We have our companionship, our fellowship. We were born here. We were christened here. Our parents were married here. The children come here. So this is the history of the church.
Bella is one of the many women who come here twice a week, beginning right after Mardi Gras. Their attention to these pastries is thorough, a tradition that Bella's sister Pauline insists has been maintained through generations.
But every Greek house, they would do it, and they still do. A lot of them still do. I don't anymore. I buy them from from the church now. It's easier.
She remembers how her father would make his own phyllo dough when she was a child.
We put sheets on the beds, you know, on the top of the beds, clean sheets, because we had to spread it out on there as well as the table and any place that we could, we would spread it out. It was definitely like cigarette paper, you know, when you used to roll cigarettes. Very thin. We'd just stretch it out and stretch it out. I loved baklava as a child. Oh, I used to go and sneak in and grab a piece, you know, whenever I could. So
the baklava isn't made until the days just before the festival. Right now, everyone's focused on making stuffed Phoenicia, a Greek macaroon topped with honey and nuts. The first stage is to roll out the dough, an all-hands-on-deck process.
I'm not Greek. My wife was Greek, Angeliki Gikas. So I'm Patrick Latour. I'm French. My wife and I were married 50 years ago this year, but she passed away 2 years ago. So I have continued coming to help, and I love the fellowship. You know, that's the best part of these workshops is talking to the ladies, listening to the Greek language, even though I don't know it. And I'm really the chef's helper. And I'm helping the ladies today make these balls, which is simple.
The cookies are hand-measured, inspected for uniformity, and then baked to a golden brown. Once they've cooled, they're coated in honey syrup, topped with nuts, and then frozen until the festival. Inside the kitchen, Mary Kontos stands alongside the mixture that tops the Phoenicia.
It's 225 pounds of sugar. The water, you mark it over where it says 15, and you put cloves, cinnamon, and lemon juice, about 3 3/4 worth of lemon juice. And you also put the peel in the vat, and then it cooks for an hour. And after it cooks for an hour, you put in honey. And I make that 7 times.
Helen Malachias is making sure that everyone has enough to eat. She's got plenty of inspiration to pull from. On a top shelf are 4 binders full of handwritten recipes.
The recipes is a combination of family, people who have lived here and have moved out that have left us with recipes. And we have, you know, just tried and tried and tried them, and now we're enjoying them. I would have to say, in my instance, my mother, we use one of the recipes for galata burrica, and my mother used it like 60, 70 years, and, you know, she brought it from Greece, and, you know, she refined it here with the ingredients that she could find here. And then other things, she would have a Greek paper that was delivered to her in this little small town of DeRidder, and she picked up recipes from there. So those recipes are probably older. You know, we owe this. We owe this to the people, to the pioneers. I owe it to my family. I owe this to my family because my mother was such a great baker, such a great cook, and she appreciated everything to be pretty, not just, you know, baked. She wanted it to look pretty.
This streamlined production utilizing modern appliances hasn't always been possible. Here's Sandy Buzon.
There was a number of years that we didn't have a facility, so at that point we were making them in our individual homes. You know, we would make one item at my house, another item at her house, you know, and the ladies would all come one day and we would bake in our homes and bring them here. And some of our ladies out here, I don't know if they told you, but they're in their 90s. I made them laugh the first workshop we had this year. It kind of takes a little while to get going. So our first workshop, they said, how did workshop go? I said, oh, it went great. We had 12 people and 3 of them were in their 90s. That kind of gives you an idea. But if we didn't have the older ladies, we couldn't function. Because, see, they're the backbone. We mix the product, but they put the product together. If we didn't have all those hands, we couldn't make these massive amounts.
As I looked at all those smiling faces, so delighted to be sharing each other's company, I noticed very few belong to the younger generation. Where are they?
Well, first of all, they work. They have professions, okay? Secondly, they probably are used to mama making this pastry at home, and they figure mama's going to be around all the time. I don't need to learn, you know. It's a shame, though, because my husband says, well, how long are you going to do this? And I said to him, it won't be our choice. The choice will be made for us for one reason or another. But as long as we can come over here, we truly do it with all our hearts. But I feel like the young women in our community will step up when the time is needed, and they will do what they can do. It won't be what we're doing.
What do you think will change?
Well, they won't make as many varieties. They might order.
That would be shocking.
Well, I mean, you know, the Greek festival still has to go on. But I can't, you know, really and truly, I trust that they can do it if they are challenged to do it.
As Helen prepared the next batch of dough for the afternoon session, lunch was served and a traditional prayer was sung. As bowls of salad were passed, I thought about Helen's words and expressed my concern with Kathy Katsoulis-Vial and Rania Mantikos.
You know, the thing is that the society has changed a lot so that our children are working now, and sometimes both husband and wife are working. It's a little bit difficult for them to come to do workshops. But we do have nighttime workshops where a lot of them do come. We'll pass it on to them.
And we like to keep the tradition, whatever we do, you know, keep going the same.
Like everyone in New Orleans is, and all over, enjoy our traditions, so they keep coming to our festivals and enjoy the food and the pastries and the music. So that's what we're aiming to, just perpetuate the culture.
I mean, bon appétit.
Food also plays an important role in the sacred liturgy of the Greek Orthodox Church. At Holy Trinity Cathedral, the bread used is baked on premise by members of the congregation. I found Maggie Spiros and Connie Tiliakis in the cathedral's kitchen following that time-honored tradition.
My name is Magdalene Spiros Mag.
My name is Connie Tiliakis. It's short for Constance. I'm first generation Greek on both sides. My work here is with the Ladies Philoptical Society. I'm president. We're a philanthropic organization. Philoptikos means friends of the poor. I'm in my third year, and I'm enjoying working with all of the ladies here. We're about close to 100 strong, so we have a lot of support. We're working here today with the Archive Committee, and also I'm a member of that committee, and we're working very hard to preserve all our historical collection and also to have it on display as often as we can.
We have been here through thick and thin, war, disease, disruptions, dissension, consistently. But we know that there was a church in Galveston, probably predated our 1864 beginning by 1 or 2 years. They didn't survive. We know that there was an Orthodox priest in New York, a Russian Orthodox priest in New York attached to the Russian consulate, never could get a church off the ground. And when they did in the late 1800s, it actually ruptured.
I know that you all have not forever been right here in this beautiful church on the banks of Bayou St. John. Tell me about the other places that the churches have been located here in New Orleans.
Well, our oral history tells us that the Orthodox Christians, coming from many different countries, gathered at the Greek consul Nicholas Benaki's home on Bayou Road, right on the edge of Treme, in 1864. We have documentation that in 1865, a group of Orthodox Christians, Turkey, Austria, Greece, and Russia, met and started to raise funds to build an Eastern Orthodox church. Because if anyone studies the history of Eastern Orthodoxy in America, in fact, in the very, very beginning, it was multi-ethnic. The first church was at 1222 North Dorginois, right in Treme. And if anyone reads Richard Campanella's chapter in his book, Geographies of New Orleans, what he maintains is we were unique in that usually there's a community of like immigrants, and then they build a church. In our case, there was a church, and then everyone settled around the church.
You mentioned to me that there are, aside from the well-known dishes that are served at the Greek festival, there are a lot of very important foods that figure strongly in the church community. Would you tell us about those?
One of these is called artoglassia, arto. It's for the health of a person. So it's a sweet bread, and we make 5 loaves, and we bring them to church early in the morning before the orthros, before the first service. And these loaves are blessed and served to the people after services.
What are the other kinds of bread and other foods?
Well, I was mentioning to Connie that there are some food liturgical traditions in our faith. And the Artoclasia is certainly one of the ones that come to mind. But our Prosforon, which is the bread that's distributed during our communion service, is a very important liturgical food tradition. And so there is a group of people in our church who traditionally will bake the Prosforon, and then the Greek word is to be offered. It's an offering. And the Prosforon is baked under certain liturgical conditions. When it's being baked, there are prayers, there are hymns. That particular bread is blessed and is used by our priest in the communion cup with the wine and distributed to those who are to take communion. However, there's also the Prosforon that is given out to anyone who is in attendance in church that day. They don't have to be Orthodox. And that is called the Andideron, meaning instead of the gift. The gift would be the blessed Prosforon, which is used in communion. The Andideron is the Prosforon that anyone can partake of. And we always have little pieces of bread that are disseminated at the end of our liturgy. Now, I think to answer your previous question, it might help to know how we do communion. And that's how they would get their Artoclasia also. And it would be the end of the service as people go forward to pick up their Andideron. If we've had an Artoclasia, they would also get their slice of Artoclasia. And that happens at the end of the service. I really love the whole idea of koliva. The koliva is the boiled wheat that is made sweet and then presented to anyone who is here. I'm an immigrant. I was born in Greece, and my family went back multi-generations in Greece. When we do koliva, it provides me an opportunity to think of them all, and it touches me. And I also remember memories of being in Greece and going to the cemetery where all of my ancestors are buried in a little village, you know, just 30 kilometers north of Kalamata. They grew those wonderful olives that everybody knows about. And I remember going to the cemetery and having koliva as I'm looking at the tombstones of all my, you know, all of my ancestors.
You know, one of the things that Maggie was, you know, we were talking about food, and that is Greek Easter. I have family and friends who, when it gets close to Greek Easter, they call me and say, when is Greek Easter? Because they know they're going to get pasticcio, they're going to get moussaka, they're going to get the baked lamb, they're going to get the spanakopita, the kouloudia, the baklava, all of the basic sweets that I make. And now I have actually people within the family that want to learn how to do this because you know, as I get older, I don't know how much longer I'll be able to do it by myself. And so when they ask, can I bring something, I always tell them no, because what are you going to bring? You're going to bring a potato salad to Greek Easter? So I say, well, just come on over and you can help me, you know, you can help me with maybe the turopitas and roll them up, or the grape leaves, the domadas, you know, make those. And so gradually I have a couple of people who now say, can I bring the domadas? And I say, as long as you don't buy them in a can and make them yourself, yes, you can bring the domadas.
Let me tell you what I'm impressed with when it comes to the history of the foods. When I came back after having moved away for 20, 30 years, I don't remember, and started coming to workshops, I was amazed that when we make some of our cookies, some of our sweet things, they're using recipes that require more work, more expense, when someone could argue it's not necessary, and they insist on using those traditional recipes. For example, clarified butter. When I'm making my sweet things at home, do I clarify my butter? No, not anymore. I did, but not anymore. They are still using clarified butter for these cookies that they make. That just amazes me. I just think, oh my goodness, this is something so, and they will do it that way. That's what they think. That's how they believe it should be done. That's the appropriate way to do it. And it doesn't matter if we're cooking for however many thousands of people who come to the festival.
Maggie Spiros and Connie Tiliakis of Holy Trinity Cathedral. The Holy Trinity Greek Orthodox Church celebrates its annual Greek festival this year from May 22nd to the 24th. More information about the church and its festival is available on their website, holytrinitycathedral.org.
What makes that extra virgin olive oil extra virgin? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What makes extra virgin olive oil extra virgin? Extra virgin olive oil is the juice that comes from the very first pressing of the olives. That makes it the very best of the olive oils. It's usually deep green in color and has a very fresh, almost sweet flavor of olives. Extra virgin olive oil is the only cooking oil made without the use of chemicals and industrial refining. After the first pressing, it can't legally be called virgin. That's because with each continued extraction, the quality lessens. The lowest grade is called pomace, which is often treated with heat and chemicals to get that last precious bit of oil out of the mash. Pomace is also the cheapest. But pomace has a very high smoke point, so if you're frying with olive oil, pomace is your best bet. But for your salad, break out that extra virgin. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Internist Dr. Tim Harlan is medical director at the Tulane University School of Medicine. But before he was a doctor, Tim was a chef and restaurateur. He carries that culinary interest forward today with his alter ego, Dr. Gourmet. Tim, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
It is fabulous to be here, Poppy.
Tell us about the Mediterranean diet.
When we talk about Mediterranean diet from the nutrition literature, what it really means is a way to look at the ingredients that go into those foods, into the pantries, if you will, and the refrigerators of those folks who live in countries that surround the Mediterranean. So while you might think that it's about recipes, it's really about the food. And those are nine basic principles. But those nine are really simple, and they're really common sense. More fruits and nuts, more vegetables, more whole grains, and less refined grains. So more whole wheat flour, more brown rice, etc. Legumes, big, big fan of legumes. Beans, peas, peanuts, peanut butter. Better quality fat and more unsaturated, less saturated fat. Lean meat and less meat. They don't eat a lot of meat, but they do eat meat. And meat's okay, but it's the quality of meat. So red meat is not bad for you, but bologna, hot dogs.
Hello.
You know, exactly. More fish. They do consume more fish. Dairy, less dairy and lower fat dairy. And then the last one is alcohol in moderation. You know, it's kind of hard to keep all nine of those straight in your head, but you can go to the drgourmet.com website. There's section after section that'll explain all that to folks.
So what are the benefits? What's this going to do for you?
Well, again, the research says that when they look at Mediterranean diet score, so they take those nine elements, and if you're good in an element, you get a point on the Mediterranean diet score. If you're not so good, you don't get a point. It's really just that simple. And when they looked at these cultures, if you just improved your score, say from a 5 to a 7, so you ate more whole grains and you ate more vegetables, that's it. You just make that simple change. You reduce your risk of dying. This is death, what we think of as the ultimate endpoint in research.
It's worse than being fat.
Right, worse than being fat. Reduce mortality from all causes by 25%. I mean, it's huge. It doesn't take a lot of changes. So what I do as Dr. Gourmet, there are two parts of this dialogue that I think get lost in America. One part is the weight gain and the obesity issue, and that's very important. But the other part of the dialogue that gets lost in that, the quality of those calories that you consume. You could be overweight, you could be obese, you could eat a Mediterranean-style diet, and I've got evidence that shows you will have much less chance of being hypertensive, diabetic, having heart disease. So it's about the quality of the food that you eat.
people often think that the food of Southern Louisiana is unhealthy. Boom, we get that stamp. But you actually see similarities between the Mediterranean diet and the way we eat.
Well, we live in Louisiana, so you got to stop and think about who's owned Louisiana. French have owned Louisiana. The Spanish have owned Louisiana. So there's these big Mediterranean influences right out of the blocks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Holy Trinity is Spanish. You know, all of these spices that we use in the South especially, but also specifically in Louisiana, they're very Spanish, very French. There's a big Italian influence. We have this North African influence. So all of these influences, you know, red beans and rice is in many ways the epitome of Mediterranean diet. Think about it in terms of the 19th century. Unfortunately, what happened in the 20th century and after World War II is a lot of those really fantastic recipes, they got corrupted. You know, rather than starting with great quality olive oil, people start with a big glob of lard or a big glob of Crisco, even worse.
The worst.
And so a lot of those recipes that are very prototypical Mediterranean, shrimp etouffee, red beans and rice, gumbos, you know, all of these are very, very Mediterranean in their origins.
Well, Dr. Gourmet, please come back and visit with us again on Louisiana Eats.
It is always a joy to be with you.
Dr. Tim Harlan, also known as Dr. Gourmet. After spending time with the members of Holy Trinity Cathedral, I was fascinated by the ancient traditions of Greek culture still observed today. Food writer and Greek food authority Rosemary Barron explained how traditional Greek cuisine survived through the ages and is likely to continue far into the future.
I was born in London just after the Second World War, and I went to a very, very good school where I became very interested in Greek history and Greek archaeology, and actually even did a little bit of ancient Greek. So when I left school and went to university, my first interest was archaeology, and I ended up on the island of Crete in 1963.
What was Crete like when you landed there in the 1960s?
It was a very, very strange place. There were virtually no roads. There was, I think, 20 kilometers of tarmac road. There was no airport. And to go to the dig, the east coast of Crete took nearly 2 days to get there. Now, if you arrived on Crete at the airport, it would take you probably 2.5 hours to drive. There was no electricity on the island. And in fact, what I realized just recently was it was about 18 years after Ansel Keys, an American, Ansel Keys was American from an American university, did an interesting study on the health of people throughout the world compared to the health of those in America. And that was because people in America were getting heart attacks and people in other parts of the world weren't. And Crete in 1947 had come out of the Second World War, desperately poor, desperately, desperately poor. And yet 90-year-olds were working in the fields without heart attacks. Which isn't to say that 90-year-olds should work in the fields.
But the fact that they could was pretty remarkable.
Exactly. And this interested Ansel Keys, and he put it down to the way of life there. And I only knew this afterwards, after I'd been there. But the place really fascinated me because I was digging and finding these incredible painted pots that the Minoans, who were the first civilization of Western Europe, did. And they were depicting the same kind of food on their pots in their paintings as we were still eating 2,000 years later, with the exception of things like, we had tomatoes, we had potatoes, which of course are New World, but it was the fish and the beans and the olive oil and the yogurt. On Crete, I'd learned there's a continuity in food, and it was extremely healthy. I felt better when I was on Crete than I did when I lived in London.
So the health. The great health benefits of eating Greek food. Recently for Zester Daily, of course, you're very well published. You've been in countless publications aside from your own two books. But recently for Zester, you wrote an article, 8 healthy food tips that the Cretans knew first. So what is, explain who the Cretans are, because they were pretty ancient peoples, and what were they on to that we've lost?
You're quite right, Poppy. They're an incredibly remarkable people. At the moment, it's not totally sure where they came from, but what is pretty sure is that they were not a warmongering people. What we do know is they traded with the ancient Egyptians, they traded with the Phoenicians and the Babylonians. Their function was that they were sort of a stopping off point for Egyptian knowledge.
So what are those healthy food tips that actually the Cretans had the scoop on?
The great knowledge that the Cretans had. First of all, there was olive oil.
Ah.
And our own scientists have proved that this is a wonder food, not only with vitamins, but of course in the old days, it also provided light, soap, everything. It was life. Life itself was the olive tree. With the olive oil, there were the olives too. There was there was what they call the sixth sense, which is a sense of community. And we all know that if we sit down at the table in a bad temper or with people we don't like, our stomachs get a bit knotted. What the Cretans understood, the ancient Cretans understood, was that the great human way forward was to eat in a community, to eat in a communal way, and at peace with others at the table. And that was what they called the sixth sense, and it was the sense that gave them the great digestion.
So, Rosemary, why do you think that those foods that can be traced back centuries and centuries to those ancient peoples, the beans, the various things that were being found and stored in those clay jars, why has that endured?
In some ways, I think it was a sort of one of these accidents of life. Greece has a very complex and interesting history, and it's also one of being left behind in the Industrial Revolution. So Crete itself became a place with this incredibly rich history, incredibly rich knowledge. Yet in terms of industrial Europe of, let's say, 20th century Europe, was way behind. And what that meant was their way of life was essentially almost the same as it had been for centuries. There were some differences. Some foods from the New World had entered, tomatoes, potatoes, New World beans. But essentially, it was the same life that was being lived 2,000 years earlier. That is, the fish from the Mediterranean and the Libyan Sea to the south, the Old World beans of favas, chickpeas, peas, most especially the wild greens. And this was the same as the Minoans, 2,000-3,000 years earlier. And the pots that we were digging up had these beautiful motifs of wonderful octopi and shellfish and goats and greens. And we were eating these same foods. And I put it down to the fact that the infrastructure of the country was extremely poor. There were, as I say, no roads, no electricity. And people were living a life that was extremely sustainable.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we talk with the James Beard Humanitarian of the Year, Michelle Nishan.
Food can save everything. It's the building block of all culture, and I believe it's these citizens of poverty that are going to be the heroes of our changed food system.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Bacardi USA and Dickey Brennan and Company. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Chris Kehoe, and Sarah Holtz. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.